and welcome to On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. I'm your host, Hannah Stanley. Today's episode is Overcoming Barriers to Mental Health. Before we begin with our guest at the moment, I want to ask each of you to hit subscribe if you've not already so you don't miss a moment of our topics. With me today is Dr. Neil Bakian, professor in Adler's Doctor of Psychology and Clinical Psychology Program. Neil, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Hannah.
Of course. Now, when we're talking about integrating behavioral and mental health with primary care, what exactly does that look like? How's that landscape play out?
Okay, so the integration of psychology with primary care, there are a couple of important things that we're trying to achieve. And so the main one is, let me start with an example. So an example is a person goes in to see their doctor, their primary care physician, and the doctor notices something is a little off. Maybe the person has depression, maybe the person has anxiety. And so the doctor will call in a primary care psychologist right on the spot. The psychologist will come in, do a quick evaluation, sometimes as short as 15 minutes, maybe it'll take a little longer, and then come back to the doctor and say, okay, the person has anxiety or the person has depression. You could consider the person for some medication. I'll see the person for 3 or 4 sessions and provide some stress management training. And between those two things, we could have a significant difference in their response. So by having the care be available on site, it makes a huge difference. If, for example, the physician had to say to the patient, go see this psychologist somewhere else across town, attrition rates are enormous. I don't have the figure off the top of my head, but my recollection is it's somewhere around 50% don't even keep the appointment. So before you've even started, you've lost half of the possible people who need help.
And so that the ideal would be to have somebody who's able to come in to the current appointment and consult.
Exactly.
Or at least have them in the same office.
Right. So those are both models. But the ideal is for the person to be able to be available to come in and consult kind of at a moment's notice. And there are settings out there that work exactly that way. And there's basically no wait time, and yet the psychologist is busy all day. So it's not a problem from a logistics standpoint in most of the settings that are doing that right now.
And then because the patient has already created a rapport mm-hmm. with the psychologist, mm-hmm. does the frequency of them keeping further appointments increase versus having, like you had mentioned before, where if you have to go outside or seek it at a later time, you're losing about 50% of those patients.
Exactly. And once somebody actually has the first appointment with the psychologist, then the likelihood of them coming back for a second appointment, if needed, goes way up. And there's a couple of things that are also very important about this. The idea of this model is to catch things earlier. So maybe there's a problem. It's sort of, you know, it's not that extreme at this point. And let's take an example from depression. Person goes into their doctor. It's caught right away. The person goes to see the psychologist. They get a little bit of training. They get some medication from their physician. Okay, so then the depression starts to resolve. Fast forward that to the person has not been diagnosed and not been treated for a year and a half, 2 years. Now the person's depression has caused all kinds of problems. Now there are marital problems. Now there are problems in his relationship with his kid. Maybe he's lost his job, or maybe he's in trouble at work. Most people don't know that depression is one of the leading causes. It may even be the leading cause of disability at work. So now this person has some real problems. In addition to having the problems that he had that led him to be depressed in the first place, now he has all these things that are a consequence of the depression itself that have made the depression so much worse and so much more difficult to treat. And that's why one of the things that we see is that when you add primary care psychology to the system, the total cost goes down, even including the cost of paying the psychologists. So studies that I'm aware of have shown that health savings can be up to a third. You can actually save a third on the overall medical bill by bringing in psychology and psychological kinds of interventions. And it's for exactly this reason. It's because you're preventing all these complications that otherwise are such a natural consequence of a mental illness.
So it's an early intervention program.
Exactly. So that's one of the key ideas, is prevention and early intervention.
One of the things we've talked about consistently is the stigma of admitting that you need mental health, admitting that you might need mental health, or actually admitting that you have sought it. And how can we reduce and eliminate that through this plan?
Yeah, it's a huge societal problem. And thank goodness there are people out there who are working on this very vociferously in a lot of different ways. I know the Brandon Marshall Foundation, for those of us here in Chicago, and I know he's on the Jets now, but he has done fantastic work in destigmatization. One of the ways that this model helps is that by the psychologist being part of the team, you're just another member of the team now as a psychologist, rather than mental health being this separate and distinct kind of thing. It's just part of healthcare. There's a very powerful implicit message that if the physician and the physician's assistant and the nurse and the psychologist are all there and they're all wearing lab coats of one color or another, it's very clear that this is a team and they're all doing sort of kind of basically the same thing. And that message is very, very powerful. And certainly that was the case when I was working at the VA, where they have a team model and they've had a team model for a long time. I was just part of the team. And in part, that's how I was seen. I'm not saying that it made the stigma of mental illness go away entirely. We still have that problem. But it really was a very, very helpful step in overcoming those kinds of barriers.
So it becomes very cooperative, mm-hmm. team effort. And so the patient themselves doesn't necessarily feel that this is a big stepping stone.
Right.
This is just part of who they offer up as an option.
Yeah. And especially once you start getting into the actual interventions themselves, people start recognizing that the line between mental illness and physical illness is not as hard and fast as they thought. So, for example, one of my areas of work is pain management. And one of the things that I think surprises people is that since pain is so obviously physical, you know, you have pain and you hurt. People aren't necessarily aware that there are behavioral things that we can do that can cut pain very dramatically. So, for example, you could use hypnosis or biofeedback or relaxation training or biofeedback. There's a variety of different interventions that we can use that actually reduce chronic pain by about 50% on average. Now, just to give a point of reference, when we talk about orthopedic pain, so low back pain, neck pain, the kind of pain that a lot of people have, the comparable figure for morphine, the most powerful anti-pain drug in the world, is 30%. You only get about 30% pain reduction in morphine for orthopedic pain, whereas our behavioral techniques get about 50%. Exercise also can work in that regard. There's a lot of mechanisms, a lot of ways to explain this, but the bottom line is that all pain ultimately comes down to an interpretation in the brain. The brain has to say that you're in pain. And there are a lot of things we can do to influence our brain in that regard. So if we use relaxation or hypnosis or meditation, any of those techniques, we can actually reduce our experience of pain. Chronic pain conditions I'm talking about, very tough to treat. People have had them for years. We can reduce those by about 50%.
And a very good example of perhaps a patient who wouldn't necessarily keep that appointment because this doesn't fit into a normal category of mental health care.
Totally outside of their radar screen. There's just a lot of things that people don't know that we can do in an area called behavioral medicine, where the behavior is the medicine for all kinds of medical diseases. They're just not on the radar screen. There's also things, for example, like with diabetes, the reduction in complications can be enormous if you involve some kind of other healthcare workers other than physicians and nurses, where the person can have ongoing support to help them to stay on their diet. very hard to stay on a diabetic diet for a long period of time, and people know that it's for life, and that gets very discouraging. It's not like anybody can resist something for a short period of time, but to try and say, no, this is it, this is how it's going to be forever, that gets really difficult. But we can work with people, and we can really get much better adherence with their diet if we work with them on these kinds of issues. So some of the things are very behavioral, and they're very common sense. It's just like, yeah, of course you're going to have a better outcome with your diabetes if you have somebody who is staying on their diet and exercising. Helping to motivate people to exercise is something else that we do. It's the line that I use with my students is, you would have to be in a cave in Afghanistan to not know that we all need to exercise more. It's on the media all the time. It's in newspapers. It's on TV. Everybody knows that we as Americans should be exercising more, but people don't necessarily do it. And working with people using motivational techniques, specialized motivational techniques to help people to overcome those barriers makes a huge difference, and people change their behavior.
But because these are items that are so out of the box for so many people, I think the vast majority of the public would think mental health care is sitting on a couch and talking about your childhood or something along those lines.
Yeah.
But I can see where, especially if you would tell someone who's very set in their ways, you should go see a psychologist. They will help you with your diet or your pain management. And they would walk out and say, oh, malarkey, and then throw that away.
You're 1,000% correct.
So then to have this in office where you go, hold on a minute, I'm going to bring in a consultant, and then the psychologist is able to walk in and chat with them where it's not the same setting. They don't have to make a separate appointment and take extra time off of work.
Right.
So now we're seeing, and we've discussed the benefits of treating mental health for mm-hmm. mental health concerns.
Right.
And we've discussed the thoughts of treating mental health for physical health reasons,
right,
which is very, very intriguing and, mm-hmm. and really, like I said, I think out of the box. Now, how do we implement this?
Mm-hmm.
How do we make this work for everyone?
It's a great question. One of the things that's exciting to me is part of the Affordable Care Act are financial incentives to work as teams. And the reason for that is exactly everything that we've been talking about. And very often, something that really helps push legislation like this is that it will save money. It'll save money for the government. It'll save money for the healthcare system. We all know.
Much like the early intervention is saving money for that patient and their
insurance. Exactly. So that with these incentives put in place, and the reason that they're there is to say, yes, if we integrate teams. And my area of expertise is just like mental and physical. So, you know, physicians and that kind of healthcare team plus psychologists being added to the mix, we know that the overall healthcare costs go down. And what that indicates is that there's less of a need for medical intervention. So there's not only less, it's not only less expensive, there's also less suffering involved. So that combination, I think, is really, really compelling. There are also people who are in private businesses who are starting businesses to help to create these integrated systems. And it's kind of catching on. But I hear your question. When you go to your doctor today, it's not likely that a psychologist is necessarily going to be someone on the staff. And our dream is that someday that it would be the unusual clinic that doesn't have a psychologist rather than the way it is now. It should be that we're just kind of part of this, like, routinely, just because of all the benefits that we've been discussing.
Yeah, because one of the I wouldn't say benefits of going to the hospital, but if you were to go to the hospital with something like this, these staffers would be there. You mm-hmm. would have the psychologist that they could pull
right.
in for consult. And so now your recommendation, or maybe what the eventual goal would be, is to kind of have that in a smaller setting in each of the major offices, not necessarily
right.
small town physician, but
right.
But
right.
at least in, you know, like a more metropolitan area, that would be more the norm.
Right, exactly. And to have it in especially in larger clinics where there would be where there would be enough demand, where there would be somebody who would be employable full time to take care of all the need that there would be.
And because not every patient that you're going to see is going to need that consult.
Not everybody will. And although I think that there's a lot more, especially when we start talking about these physical health things, the psychological aspects of physical health, that most people could benefit from at least a consultation of, say, a half an hour or an hour, maybe even split over a couple of sessions, just for most things, for any kind of disorder that involves a behavioral component. And that's a surprisingly large number. I'll give you an example. One of the things that we know is that a lot of the, you know, the mysteries of the mind-body connection is actually tied to what people know, most people know, which is the fight-flight response. So the fight-flight response is a very, very physical response, and we've all felt it. If you feel frightened in a frightening situation, your heart starts to pound and your palms start to sweat, and you know that feeling. If we look at what happens from a chemistry standpoint with the fight-flight response, what's happening is adrenaline is being pumped into your system, cortisol is being pumped into your system, and I'm just going to stop there. We all know what adrenaline does. It increases the activity of your heart. And one of the issues that we see in society largely is heart disease is our number one killer, right? So high blood pressure is one of our big problems. Well, if you are, through your psychological reaction, pumping adrenaline into your system, you're going to make heart disease worse, and you are going to make high blood pressure worse. Now, the cortisol is pumped into your system. Cortisol does two things. It's a powerful anti-inflammatory, but it's also a very, very powerful immune suppressant. That's why people who have organ transplants take artificial cortisone in order to lower their immune response. So now, look at what your immune system does. Your immune system is implicated in everything. Infectious disease, autoimmune problems like asthma and lupus, right? So there's these vast numbers of diseases that are tied in some way to a psychological, biological phenomenon that we're very familiar with, the fight-flight response. And the fight-flight response is triggered by just one thing, psychological perception of threat. If you feel threatened, then your fight-flight response kicks in. And this is not just to physical stress, physical threats, such as, you know, seeing a dog in an alley barking, you know, it's something scary. But it's also with regards to psychological threats. What if this person is going to leave me? What if I get fired at work?
Any type of stressor.
Right. These are all seen as threats, and they will trigger the fight-flight response to some degree, and we'll be putting the adrenaline and the cortisol into our systems, and we're going to be affecting our health in that way. So any kind of stress management program is going to help with this wide array of health outcomes, not just with mental health outcomes like depression and anxiety, but with physical health outcomes like high blood pressure, heart disease, and infectious disease.
Well, based on this information, it seems like we need to get this all integrated and ramped up.
I'm with you.
Okay. Neil, thank you so much for your time and for informing all of us about what you see as the future and hope to be the future in everybody's healthcare model. When we come back, we are going to talk about reducing stigma and understanding mental health, which we sort of touched on with you, but we'll do so more in our next segment. Hannah Stanley, this is On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. And again, if you'd take a moment and hit subscribe so these auto-populate in your device, that would be great. Thanks for listening.